Hello, ladies, gentlemen, and otherwise. This is Mike. Before we begin, I just wanted to say that though my co-host Nancy and I do our best to give you the best information that we can, neither she nor I are doctors or nurses or any kind of currently licensed medical professional. We hope to educate and entertain in equal measure, but please don't take anything we say in this podcast as a substitute for speaking to your own doctor. If you have any specific medical questions about your situation, talk to your doctor. They're going to give you better answers than we possibly could. Oh, hey, and you may want to listen all the way to the end of this one. No particular reason. Just saying.
Hi, listeners. Welcome to this week's episode of My Favorite Malady, a medical history podcast out of the Mutter Museum. My name is Nancy Hill. I am the museum manager, and I'm here with my fellow science goth.
Hi, I'm Mike.
It's Mike.
Hey.
On this podcast, we are going to talk about our favorite medical incidents, events, individuals, etc. There is a whole world of interesting stuff out there, and we'd like to talk about them in a casual, fun format. We do, however, want to make sure our listeners are aware that we're not mocking these people or events. Rather, sometimes we have to balance dark topics with dark humor, and we're talking about these things not because we think that they're funny, but because we think they're significant and we want to share them. We might swear and censor it out, but we do try to keep things PG. However, some of the subjects we discuss address sexual health, violent events, etc., and they might not be suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. So, Mike, you're first this week. What is your favorite malady?
My favorite malady? I'm actually doing a twofer. You're getting a bonus malady because I'm doing chimney sweep scrotum and also mule spinner scrotum, which are two similar.
Neither of those sound like good things to me.
No. Well, no. I mean, it's a malady. But yeah, both of these things are separate but somewhat related scrotal cancers. So let's get into it. Last week, Nancy, you talked about an occupational disease, fossy jaw, which was a 19th century occupational disease in Britain, right?
Yep.
I'm doing another 19th century occupational disease in Britain. Actually, this was 18th century and into the 19th. Chimney sweep scrotum was so called because it was identified in chimney sweeps in Britain. And the interesting thing is that this was an almost uniquely British and slightly American, but almost uniquely British malady. Because chimney sweeps in Britain had much lower occupational safety standards in the 1800s than they did in most of the rest of Europe. So German chimney sweeps didn't, by and large, get chimney sweep scrotum because they wore protective clothing. They were adults. They had a whole guild that protected them. Guild is like a kind of a very early form of union. But in UK, it was basically the Wild West as far as safety regulations went. And what they did was they used young boys because after the Great Fire of London, they started to make chimneys smaller and smaller, and so adults couldn't climb through them anymore.
Yeah, I don't know if we want to explain and cut this if we don't, but soot is essentially unburnt fuel from a fire. And the reason that you need to clean out your chimney is because if enough soot builds up, the soot itself can catch on fire, and your chimney is just shooting fire out the top of it, which is basically how that big fire of London started. So chimneys were a huge fire hazard because people didn't quite understand the kind of physics of fire. And so there is a ratio of chimney opening to hearth size to basically make sure that the smoke actually goes up the chimney and not into the room. That's why they made chimneys smaller for anyone who's confused about why they would do that.
Right. And the size of the flue, which is the opening from the hearth to the chimney, was as little as 23 by 35 centimeters, which is 9 by 14 inches. So imagine a hole that's 9 by 14 inches. And then imagine trying to get somebody up there. You'd have to get a small child, right? Nobody else is going to fit in there. So you take a child as young as six to eight, usually. You'd strip them naked because you don't want their clothes to get caught. And then you jam them up that chimney with a brush and be like, hey, good luck. Scrub it out.
They were naked?
Yes, because you don't want their clothes to get caught on stuff, because sometimes their clothes would get caught and then they couldn't move.
Yeah.
Now, even as it was, there was a shockingly high rate of mortality among these sweeping boys, because they just get trapped in there. You know, the chimney would get caked in soot, and they try to get around a sharp corner, and they get caught in the soot, and they couldn't move forward, and they couldn't move back, and they just suffocate.
Goodness.
Yes, it was terrible. But chimney sweep scrotum was actually a disease of older men. What would happen is you'd have all these exposures when you were young, and then you might quit this chimney sweeping game because, you know, you grew up. And then 20 years later, you'd get this horrible scrotal affections.
It was kind of a delayed onset of the illness.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. So there are stories of sailors that went to sea for 20 years who hadn't been near a chimney in 20 years, and then all of a sudden they'd come down with this stuff. The median age for experiencing it was 37 and a half years old. But goodness. Most of the men that got it were exposed in their youth.
As small children.
So the first time it was described was in 1775 by a doctor whose name, I swear to God, this was his name. This is not a Harry Potter character. Percival Pott.
That's a dope name, though.
Yeah, right? I saw a picture of him. He just looks like, you know, a guy in a white wig like George Washington. So he didn't look like a Harry Potter character, but that is a pretty great name. It was actually described earlier than him, but they didn't kind of associate it with being a chimney sweep. They thought it was, and again, we don't use this word anymore, but at the time, they described it as a venereal illness before they figured out that it was actually occupational exposure. And it is actually, I think, the first occupational exposure disease of the industrial age. Yeah, so you're a boy, you're stripped naked very often. Sometimes you had to wear clothes, depending. You're shoved up the chimney, you had to scrub it out. And what would happen is you would naturally sweat, and your sweat would drip down your body and carry the soot and tar that's covering your entire body down your body, and it would naturally accumulate in your scrotum, which is wrinkly. Correction from the future here. On your scrotum, not in, on. That's a weird mistake to make, huh? So the wrinkles of the scrotum would trap these soot and dirt particles. And very often, chimney sweeps wouldn't bother bathing because you're just going to get covered in soot and tar the next day, right? Like, what's the point of bathing? So they might go days or even weeks between baths. And so your scrotum would just accumulate all of this soot and tar and basically hydrocarbon byproducts. And eventually, they discovered that a lot of these were carcinogenic compounds. You know, I mean, it's not a big surprise. You know that from inhaling smoke, you can get cancer. And so the chimney sweeps in Germany, they did not get to use young boys. They had to be just small adults. Also, they wore tight-fitting clothes, either like a jacket that's very tightly belted and pants that are tucked into shoes and this kind of hood thing. Or sometimes they wore what looked more like a very, very tight sweatsuit, essentially. But it was still very tight to the body. And like the wrists and ankles were tied off. And so they would not get the soot on their actual bodies. Whereas in Britain, you just, if you wore anything at all, you wore like loose-fitting rags. This is how Percival Pott, again, actual real dude, described the disease.
Before you dive into it, I do have a chimney sweep story that's not related to cancer, but a comical one nonetheless. So
knock it out.
If you want it now?
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people think of chimney sweeps as like an like old-timey Mary Poppins thing.
Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim chiri.
Chimney sweeps still exist. It is still important to maintain your chimney if you wish to use your fireplace. So my mom was born in the States, but she grew up in Switzerland. And when she was a child, my aunt came to visit. My grandparents went out and they neglected to tell my aunt that the chimney sweeps would be coming. My aunt did not speak Swiss German. So she's in the home with these two young children, and a man comes out of the chimney covered in soot. And, you know, this again is the mid to late 60s. And even for her, she thought that chimney sweeps were only a Mary Poppins thing. Right. And so she starts yelling at this man and hitting him, trying to get him to get out of the house. And he's kind of laughing and trying to explain to her in a language that she doesn't understand that he's the chimney sweep. And he needs someone to sign this thing, this invoice. And so it eventually one of the children who did speak Swiss German had to explain, no, that's a chimney sweep. He's not an intruder. Sometimes men come out of the chimney. So my aunt still gets picked on a little bit from something that happened, you know, many decades ago when she was a teenager for trying to fight a chimney sweep and protect my mother and her brother.
It wasn't Dick Van Dyke, was it?
No, it was some Swiss man, but apparently they looked very much like the chimney sweeps in Mary Poppins, but because they're wearing all black because of the soot, they also look like burglars to her. So she thought the home was about to be burgled. And
burglars in blackface. Your face would also
It's all dirty and stuff. But, sometimes men will just come out of your chimney.
Oh, blow me a kiss, and that's lucky too.
So Percival Pott, he described the men and boys who were engaged in this trade thusly. The fate of these people seems singularly hard. In their early infancy, they are most frequently treated with great brutality and almost starved with cold and hunger. They are thrust up narrow and sometimes hot chimneys. Oh yeah, that's another thing, is sometimes the chimneys were still hot when they're working on them. In fact, there were reports of boys being motivated to climb faster by having a fire lit under them. Awful. Noisome, painful, and fatal disease, where they are buried, burned, and almost suffocated, and, when they get to puberty, become liable to a most noisome, painful, and fatal disease.
Is that where the phrase lighting a fire under one's tush comes from?
I bet it is, actually.
Huh.
I hadn't thought about that, but that makes perfect sense, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's awful. Ugh. So, the disease first manifested as a scrotal wart that they called soot warts. And they were extremely common among chimney sweeps. Some chimney sweeps would have hundreds of them. And the normal, brace yourself, gentlemen, the normal way to treat them was that chimney sweeps didn't even bother going to the doctor. They just cut them off with a knife themselves.
A sweep is as lucky can be.
There's one case of a chimney sweep under a doctor's care that had a wart on the scrotum, that he seized it with a split stick and cut it off with a razor. He resumed work the following day.
I wish you could see my face right now, everyone, because it's bad. And again, I know I feel like I say it every episode, but infection risk, man. Having an open wound and then you're just going to crawl back in a chimney with an open wound?
These warts could, and very often did, eventually proceed to a cancerous lesion. And here's how Pott described one. The wart and then lesion appeared on, quote, the inferior part of the scrotum, where it produces a superficial, painful, ragged, ill-looking sore with hard and rising edges. In no great length of time, it pervades the skin, dartos, and membranes of the scrotum and seizes the testicle, which it enlarges, hardens, and renders truly and thoroughly distempered, and whence it makes its way up the spermatic process into the abdomen, frequently indurating and spoiling the inguinal glands. When arriving within the abdomen, it affects some of the viscera, and then very soon becomes painfully destructive. So what he's talking about is obviously a scrotal lesion turning into cancer, that cancer metastasizing into the testicles, and then from the testicles up probably through the prostate into the abdomen, and then of course it metastasizes abdominal cancer, and it's very bad.
Did cutting off the warts at all at least slow or negate the development of the tumor, or was it something that just popped up elsewhere? Or the warts
had a
superficial manifestation?
No, I bet it would, because the warts developed into cancerous lesions, and then the lesions developed into tumors. So the same way that you might have a precancerous lesion from, like, it looks like a bad mole or something, and a dermatologist will cut it out so it doesn't become cancer. Gotcha. I imagine cutting off the warts actually probably did help. As long as you got the whole thing, of course, because if you get, if you miss the edges, then you just have like a little loop.
And I'm assuming that this happened in the scrotum and the genitals in particular because of the kind of porous. And again, we've talked previously about how it's a good place for bacteria, but also that skin is quite porous and membranous and absorbent.
And wrinkly.
Looking at World War I and gas warfare, if these are lipids that, if the gas contains corrosive lipids that can stick to things like sweat and oils, that would be why they manifest particularly in the armpits and the genital region. Is that kind of a similar phenomenon with the soot kind of adhering to the sweat glands and kind of oily areas?
Sure, yes. And again, sweat will flow down your body, oil will flow down your body. So that's kind of at the bottom of the crotch area of your body, right? Again, like you said, they're porous, they're wrinkly. There's going to be hair there, which captures soot. The other thing to remember is that these men were used to incredibly harsh conditions in their life, right? They were clearly brutally abused as children. And so a lot of them really didn't seek treatment because they're just like, oh, I guess this is a thing that happens now. Well, my scrotum's rotting. You know, what are you going to do? Life is hard. So a lot of them would wait for a very long time before they tried to seek treatment. There are some very, very graphic descriptions of how terrible some of these advanced cases were. There's one case where, like, despite the appearance of this growth, and there's a very long description of it, like a goose egg sized tumor. The only complaint was that about 10 days before his admission, he had bled from his groin and lost about a pint of blood. Now, I don't know about you, but if I start bleeding a pint of blood from my groin, that is not something I wait 10 days to go see a doctor to see.
Yeah. I mean, right? Again, if you're a menstruating person, maybe you wait. I mean, a pint is still kind of a lot, but the first few tablespoons, you're like, yeah, but.
Okay.
If you are not a menstruating person and then you start bleeding from your genitals, definitely get that looked at.
Yeah. So the treatment was very straightforward. Surgery. Just take out the testicle. And obviously, there's another tumor. You take out the rest of the tumor. But hopefully, you catch it before it metastasizes outside the testicle or outside the scrotum. But of course, this was before anesthesia. And so chimney sweeps would do almost anything to avoid the surgery because even though it was a relatively simple surgery and actually had a pretty high survival rate for surgeries at the time, I mean, no. No thank you, sir. So there was a treatment for these lesions, which involved basically an arsenic paste. And apparently this would clear the lesions up sometimes. But of course, arsenic is itself a carcinogen.
Were they using the arsenic to combat secondary bacterial infections of the area? I mean, I guess I'm wondering what the arsenic would do for the cancer itself.
Yeah, so the arsenic would basically kill off the epithelial cells, which is where the cancer lived. And the way they describe it, it was like a poultice, and the poultice would eventually come off and the skin of your scrotum would slough off with it. And then it's going to grow back, and hopefully the cancer that lived on the scrotum would be dead and gone with the skin that came off. It's still pretty brutal, but not as brutal as having your testicles removed without anesthesia.
Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheroo. Good luck will rub off when I shakes hands with you.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an awesome choice. Your options are not great.
I do actually have a pretty good description of the surgery here, but I'm going to spare everybody because it's a little bit graphic, even for us. So eventually, the British authorities realized that this was a real problem. They came up with regulations to prohibit sending small boys up chimneys. They came up with regulations for protective gear. The kind of the heyday of chimney sweep scrotum was about 100 years, between 1770 or so, 1870. But you still saw it quite a bit afterwards. Up until 1940, I think, the disease was still reasonably common among chimney sweeps, even though they got the protective gear and even though they weren't exposed as children. And, you know, I honestly wouldn't be surprised if it was still a thing today. Like, I don't see how, unless you're wearing, like, a wetsuit, you're going to keep the soot from getting to you altogether. So I'd imagine that among modern chimney sweeps, you still get a higher than average incidence of scrotal lesions.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine they're probably wearing, like, Tyvek PPE and bathing with a lot more regularity than their antique counterparts.
Certainly the bathing would help quite a bit as well, yeah. So this takes us to the bonus scrotal disease, which is a very similar disease, a very similar scrotal cancer, in fact, called mule spinner's scrotum. Now, Nancy, do you know what a mule spinner is?
No, but the assumptions that I'm making are hopefully incorrect.
So a mule spinner is what came after the spinning jenny, which is what came after the spinning wheel. Well, there was one device in between there, but it's essentially a way to spin fibers into yarn or string or thread.
That's much better than what I was assuming.
Yeah. It's called a mule spinner because it was the offspring of two previous industrial devices for spinning yarn, one of which was a spinning jenny. A jenny is a female donkey. Now, technically, the offspring of a jenny and a horse is not a mule, but a hinny. But I guess a spinning hinny didn't have the same ring as a spinning mule or the mule spinner.
I mean, so I think a spinning hinny sounds better, personally, but, you know.
Me too. So in 1910 or 1911, there was a study done of basically scrotal cancer among industrial workers, and they found that out of 40 cases that they found in the course of a year, not a single one was a chimney sweep anymore, but most of them were actually cotton mule workers.
Huh.
Yeah. And they tried to come up with reasons why one of the doctors is like, well, it's because they wear rough underwear and the underwear rubs on their scrotum and that gives them cancer.
As much as rough underwear sounds bad, it's a little bit of an intuitive leap, but I'm assuming you're going to tell me what actually was happening.
Well, the reason he came up with this, it wasn't entirely unfounded, was that wool mule spinners, so in other words, people that worked the spinning mules and only worked on wool and not on cotton, did not get this cancer for some reason. Hmm. And it was noted that wool mule spinners tended to wear wool underwear, which was soft.
Really? Whereas I feel cotton like wool mule spinners, pretty icky, but I guess maybe we're talking different levels of refinement here, different thread counts.
I don't know. I don't really know why, like, the wool mule spinner workers wore different underwear than the cotton mule spinner workers. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me either, but apparently they did. What it turns out to be was when you're working on the mule spinner, it's very, very warm, so you're not wearing a whole lot of clothing. You're usually wearing basically thin, often linen clothing, so you don't sweat to death. So your job when you're working is when the thread breaks, you stop the machine and you fix the thread. You basically tie the thread back together. You'd have to lean over the machine to tie these threads back together. And there was a bar right basically at scrotum level that you would lean over and very often lean against. And this bar was usually, because it spun when it was on, was usually coated in lubrication. And the lubrication was a mineral oil that turned out to also be carcinogenic. You just lean over this bar, which was coated in mineral oil. The mineral oil would soak through your thin clothing and get onto your scrotum, and you'd get cancer from that.
Okay, so from like the kind of particulate debris sticking to the mineral oil and not the mineral oil itself.
No. The mineral oil itself was carcinogenic.
Okay.
This went on through the early part of the 20th century, basically through till about World War II, when it declined because they got better oils. And there was a 1954 mule spinner special regulation in the UK that basically outlawed the use of the carcinogenic oils entirely, and you had to use what are called white oils of an acceptable lubricating efficiency, which was just a different kind of mineral oil that wasn't carcinogenic anymore. But otherwise, the disease...
1954, that's pretty late.
Yeah, right?
I'm sort of surprised to hear that this was so prolific in Britain, because I always associate the US with being more of a heavy cotton producer, but I guess raw materials versus refining of those raw materials, I guess, are two different things.
I swear to God, this is not going to be an episode about racism, except to say that the US had different labor practices, which let them use different kinds of machines.
Yes.
And that's all we have to say about that.
Do a Google search.
Yeah. You can figure it out on your own.
My American cotton historians.
Yes, correct.
Oh.
But yeah, so eventually a bunch of safety regulations, the elimination of the oil, they put in splash guards. They increased medical examination of the workers. So as soon as the warts showed up, instead of letting the warts progress into lesions, they would get rid of the warts immediately.
Well, I mean, I guess my only questions are kind of like, I can't help but be like, protective clothing, y'all, come on. But,
right?
You know, it was hot in the chimneys. It's probably hot in the cotton mills.
Oh, yeah.
But boy, howdy. A little leather apron could have spared us a lot of hurt, at least in the cotton production. And
child labor, of course, was also a common theme here.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people were exposed as children.
And again, we talked when we talked about Bossy Jaw, some of those girls were as young as 12, but to be 5 or 6 and shoved up a chimney is,
with a fire lit under you to motivate you.
Yeah.
And it's not like once you got out of the chimney, your life was great either, you know? Like, no, we're talking real Oliver Twist stuff here.
Yeah. No, it does sound very Charles Dickens-ish when you think about soot-covered children developing illnesses later in life.
So, Nancy, what's your favorite malady this week?
Well, my malady this week isn't really a malady. It's something that is kind of one of our frequently asked questions, and it has come up briefly in several episodes of this podcast already, so I figured it would be good to do kind of just a comprehensive talk about it. But I wanted to go talk about body donation. You know, a lot of people who come to the museum see what we've got going on and they say, I want my body in here. I want to be here when I'm dead. I want my skeleton to hang right up there. And we love that that's your response. It's great.
Thank you. It's unfortunately not as straightforward as we would like it to be. So I mentioned before in a previous episode that, you know, we're interested in prostates and specimens that relate to more modern illnesses, kind of that are ideally a product of modern life. I think a lot of people visit our collection and look around and say, gee, I'm so glad I don't have to worry about this stuff. And while that is the case for certain things, there's certainly still a lot of kind of medical investigation going on and a lot to be concerned about and to continue to research. So parts of your body that are coming out, great. Definitely email us. We'd love to hear about it and see what we can do. But in the case of full body specimens are a little bit different. So it's not super easy to donate your whole body to any museum. Personally, at the Mütter, we don't have a lab capable of full body preparation on site. And so that stuff has to be kind of contracted to offsite vendors or preparators. And due to space constraints in both storage and on display, we can't always guarantee that a whole, we'd have a spot for a whole body, a skeleton, whatever it is. And so we can't just accept anybody. Even if you have a truly exceptional and rare condition, we usually require our donors make their end-of-life plans to financially assist with preparation and transport. The kind of biggest example of this is Carol Orzel, who's the newest full-body skeleton that's come to the museum. And that was kind of an adventure in that, you know, Carol actually had to go to Indiana to Skulls Unlimited for her full-body preparation because we could not do it on site. So
Carol is, can you describe who Carol is?
Oh, so Carol Orzel is a woman. Well, she was a woman. She is currently a skeleton. She is on display in the museum with Harry Eslak, who is another full body specimen that we have. Both of them have a disease called FOP for short, or fibrodysplasia ossificans for long. It's a very rare bone growth disorder, which essentially the connective tissues ossify and turn into bone, which ultimately connects and freezes up joints and limits mobility, and it can be exceptionally painful. And so Carol was aware. Harry came to the collection upon his death in 1974. He not straight to the Mütter Museum. He did do a little bit of traveling before then, but eventually he came to us. And Carol was aware that we had Harry on display, which FOP is very rare. Most people don't know what it is or know anything about it. And so the kind of visibility that he provided for people with that condition, as well as the research opportunity. Again, we are still an active research institution. We do allow sampling for modern research. And so Harry was available for anyone who might be looking into kind of the genetics and treatment options for FOP. So Carol was aware of Harry, and she wanted her body to also come to the Mütter Museum and join him. On, you know, to be available to not only educate the public about FOP as a rare disease. Again, I believe I'd have to check the most recent stats, but their last time I talked to Dr. Frederick Kaplan, who's kind of the local Philadelphia FOP specialist, there are around 800 confirmed cases worldwide. So there are certainly more cases than that that exist, but they haven't necessarily been identified because of how rare this disease is and the very limited awareness. So just to give you an idea of the caliber of what kind of full body specimens we would accept at this point. If you're one of less than 1,000 in the world, give us a call, I guess. And you know, there's a super shortage of research specimens available, and you want to be available upon your death.
My favorite part of Carol's display is that as part of her will, she required that her jewelry go on display with her.
Oh, and yes. So she wanted her bling to go on her skeleton, but she's a little too fragile for that. So we have it next to her skeleton.
Just wonderful.
Yes. She had some really, she's an animal lover. So she has a lot of like poodles and like felted moose earrings and all kinds of fun jewelry. So definitely check that out if you ever come to visit us.
I like the moose and I like the tiara too.
Oh, yes. I love any adult woman who has a tiara in their jewelry collection. It is a serious vibe. And again, Carol in life was a very vivacious lady. I never had the pleasure of meeting her, but other members of exhibit staff
have. And she was a fashionista. She was an artist. She was really a colorful and vibrant person. So we're pleased to be able to have fulfilled her wish for her.
And, you know, last year, I think, yeah, it was last year. Good Lord. With COVID, who knows? Moved in 10 years ago. Last year, I think a bunch of her friends came to visit her skeleton. And I thought that was very moving.
Yeah, when she first came out, a bunch of her friends. So the other interesting thing about Carol is that she and Harry both lived at the same assisted living facility at different times, which is for people with pretty intensive needs. But there's quite a community of people with rare diseases and different types of mobility limitations there. So it's really cool that that Carol had a community of friends who understood her situation. And yeah, I mean, it was great. I'm sure it was very bittersweet for them, and that obviously it was unfortunate that she had died. She was about 60 when she died. So it's pretty young for modern medical, but pretty old for FOP. She lived about 20 years longer than Harry did. But, you know, this was what she wanted for herself. So hopefully it was, you know, satisfying for them to see and to know that her wishes are being respected and people are getting to talk about her every day. But if you are not as rare as Carol and you're still interested in donating your body to the advance of medical sciences, you do have other options. So the first one I will tout is organ donation. And I know that this might sound not so scientific and not so sexy as getting your body on display, but hear me out. So, you know, people think about organ donation as like the thing on your driver's license. And when you get in a horrific car wreck, they're going to give your heart to some orphan child. And it's going to be a sad and wonderful story. And that's certainly part of it. But it's not only your kind of big major organs that they can use. They can use your skin, your eyes, your bones can be used to create grafts. It's all kinds of tissues can be used. And so I say organ donation because sometimes if you are a great candidate for it, if you're healthy and your body is in good condition and can be transported relatively quickly, they can use a lot of you. And I really advocate for this because it's unbelievable how long some of these waiting lists are and how desperate people are.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if you have it in your heart and you're religious, I know some people's religion kind of excludes them from organ donation as an option. But, you know, if you're considering donating your body, I would really encourage everyone to first consider organ donation. And I will say, depending on how much of you they can take, there might not be enough of you for these other options, which is why I kind of put it first, just because ideally they will use everything they can and there will not be enough of you for these other options. But, you know, there could be. So definitely make sure you're an organ donor and let your family know that they can take whatever they want if you're comfortable with that. I know personally, I would let them. My eyes don't work so good, but if they wanted my eyeballs, my skin, my whatever it is, they can have it.
What I also say about that is twofold. One, I'm personally an advocate of opt-out organ donation. That's not a thing in the U.S., but in other countries, everybody's organs get donated as a matter of course. You have to opt out on your driver's license instead of opting in on your driver's license.
Yeah.
I think is probably the best.
Again, I think there's a lot of kind of legal, like interesting legal discussion about body autonomy that can happen here. We're not going to get into that today, but you know, it's something that you're comfortable with, one human body can save up to 8 lives, I believe is the statistic. Yes, 8 lives is what's in my note. On the average day in the U.S., 20 people die waiting for a transplant. So help them out, you know? Sign up to be an organ donor as your first matter of course if you want to donate your body.
And also, I look forward to my organs being transplanted into somebody else's body and then my spirit taking over that body.
Ooh, ghost. It's like you're ghost piloting someone else's meat robot. That could be a fun plot twist.
Yeah, that's the plan. That's the plan.
That's the plan. Yeah, you're really like preparing your body for this like weird, very literal astral projection into somebody else. All right. So if you're kind of like organ donation, like it's cool, but I want something cooler / more sciencey. All right. So your next option, or maybe you die and you're like not fresh enough or you're not healthy enough for organ donation. I guess I shouldn't make it sound like only losers don't donate their organs. Some people can't donate their organs. But your next option that I would encourage everyone to look at is donating your body to a medical school. So not
every medical school still does cadaver study, but those that do source cadavers from donors. And so this will help you kind of be literally in there with the medical students and allowing them to educate the next generation of baby doctors who will, you know, take what they've learned from you and your body and apply it to unknown numbers of living people, which is pretty cool. Personally, this is what most people in my family do. My grandfather, his body was donated to Temple Medical University. My grandmother plans on doing the same. I've mentioned before, she was a medical librarian there. But it's also, it's a great low-cost option if you're concerned about burdening your family. For us, my grandfather died at home, and so he, you know, was in bed with his dog and everything. So we gave them a call, and they came out, you know, within the same day and picked him up. They were very polite, very dignified about it. And some medical schools might return cremated remains. Most don't. Some will have like a ceremony for all of their cadaver donors that year. If you're interested in this option, the Anatomical Board of the State of Florida keeps a handy list of U.S. programs for cadaver donor study. And we can put the link for that in the description for this episode. And basically, you can contact that institution directly, that whichever one's closest to you or whichever one you feel kind of the most loyalty towards, and make those arrangements so that everybody knows when you croak to, you know, let your family know to give them a ring, and they'll know to be expecting you and go from there.
An important thing to note is that in some states, you can't donate directly to an institution. So in some states, you can't say, I want to give my body to my alma mater, whatever that school happens to be. There's actually a state board that handles donations. So you'll say, I want to donate my body to medical science.
Yes.
And the state board takes the body and then it distributes the cadavers to schools based on need.
Yes. So again, that anatomical board of whichever state you're in, again, the anatomical board of the state of Florida has a handy list of all of the UDOS programs. So you can pick the one that's closest to you. But yeah, there are some limitations. I mean, other things to keep in mind for cadaver study, there are some limitations in terms of being severely over or underweight, having transmittable disease or infection, or if you're missing too many limbs or organs. Like I said before, if you're an organ donor, sometimes you're missing too much and you can't be a cadaver study specimen. If you're someone who is an amputee. And again, if you're severely over or underweight, you might not be a good representative of the kind of general anatomy. The other thing, if you are severely overweight, storage, unfortunately, is an issue for a lot of medical schools. So if you do not fit in a standard morgue freezer, there's going to be some complications there. So just a couple of things to consider about which option might be the best for you.
On a personal note, I'm deeply appreciative to people that donate their cadavers for dissection and medical study at medical schools, because that was kind of my professional entree into the world of medical history, anatomical study, because I worked in a cadaver lab when I was in my late teens, and it really kind of opened up this whole world to me. It was really emotionally impactful experience and a personally impactful experience to be able to actually see what the inside of a person looks like, and to know that the people that I was looking at wanted me to do this. They wanted me to learn from them, and I can't think of a stronger personal connection to science than that. Plus, also, well, the cadaver lab is a very comfortable place to work. You know, I grew up in Arizona, and the cadaver lab has always kept a very cool temperature. So it was great.
I feel like we're learning so much about your origin story today.
Sure. Yeah. A part of it, anyway. I mean, I didn't say it was my first professional entree into the medical world. I have so many stories from before that. Carry on. Yeah.
There's more episodes of this show coming. So
right.
Don't want to pack it all into this one. Well, at this point, we've talked a lot about cadaver study, but you can donate your body to an educational institution for scientific research that isn't educating baby doctors. And we actually have a wee special guest here. So one of the things that your body can actually be used for is something called a body farm. And so a body farm is essentially an outdoor study laboratory where scientists of different sorts can basically observe human decomposition in different conditions, and that helps inform a number of different sciences, but obviously very helpful in this pursuit of clandestine graves and forensic science and the criminal justice aspect of death investigation. So we have here Rhiannon Watson, who is a former Mütter Museum intern and current, I guess you're a pathologist these days?
I'm a forensic toxicologist these days.
Okay, cool, cool. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your time working at the body farm you were at?
Oh boy.
Yeah, so I was at And working on the body farm was a great experience for me.
Hi all, let me explain to you what you just heard. After we recorded this, Rhiannon emailed us saying, hey, the institution where the body farm is located is kind of touchy about publicity, and maybe it'd be a good idea if we didn't use their name. So we're not going to. Every time we use their name in the recording, you're going to get an oh boy. All I can tell you about the institution is that it is an institution of higher learning in Tennessee.
They have both the outdoor research facility where we observe decomposition over a period of time to be able to help with the postmortem interval, which is basically time after death, and all different conditions, at least for Tennessee. But after that, the individuals also go into the William N. Bass Skeletal Collection, where I believe is one of the largest skeletal collections in the world. They have, I think, 9,000 skeletons and counting.
Jeez, wow.
So if you're considering donating your body, I think that is, like, body farms are a great place to go. For the
oh boy.
Specifically, if you are within 100 miles of
oh boy.
They will pick up your body and take it to the facility for no cost at all. I would recommend filling out the paperwork while you are alive, because they don't always have space for everyone. But if you fill out the paperwork, you're insured a spot on the body farm before you go.
That's good to know. So I know that some people sometimes have concerns about the sort of dignity aspect of the body farm. They're like, oh, it's just bodies laying out in a field. From our previous conversations, it's not quite as grisly as people sometimes think it is. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about some of the privacy measures that you guys had in place.
Yeah, so privacy measures start with intake. So the only person who would even know the individual's name or any sort of information like that would be the person accessioning, if you would, the individual. After that, you're completely anonymous. Photography is not allowed, except for in research papers only. And you can, when you fill out the paperwork, you can check little boxes of what you are comfortable having being done with your body for research purposes. For example, some individuals are covered with tarps so that the decomposition of them covered up over time is observed, so your body wouldn't be exposed in that sense, or other projects, they're just out. But everyone there is really respectful. They wouldn't know your name. They would only know you with the donor number. And there's definitely, like, a lot of measures taken to ensure the privacy of the individuals who are donated.
Yeah, and there's, like, a super tall fence around the facility, so people can't just, like, wander.
Oh, no. There are actually two fences, and one is coated with barbed wire, the other is wood. So no one who isn't allowed to be there would be able to see anything at all.
Yeah, they can't, like, peek in from the street or anything.
Definitely.
Did you ever have anyone try to, like, sneak in or, like...
There have been a couple cases of people trying to sneak in. One of my favorite stories is this individual decided to throw a rug over the barbed wire and hop on the fence. However, the rug slipped and he was stuck on his scrotum on the barbed wire fence, and security
more
came.
Scrotum talk. I love it.
Yeah.
The scrotum
so,
triple
that
feature
did not
this week.
End well. And obviously that man was taken care of, but that's a very rare occasion. There is security monitoring the facility and a lot of cameras to ensure that no one who isn't supposed to be there could break in or anything like that.
When you say taken care of, when you say that guy was taken care of, do you mean he wound up on the body farm?
No, I don't think so. I think he was like arrested, but I'm sure he learned his lesson after his scrotum got caught on the barbed wire fence.
So speaking purely hypothetically, if I was in the neighborhood of a body farm like the one,
oh boy,
and I happened to commit a murder, how hard would it be for me to sneak a body onto the body farm?
Very hard. First of all, the graduate students who work on the facility are out there every day. So there's almost no way that someone could just sneak an individual on there that someone wouldn't notice. It would be pretty hard to even get across the fence without being someone who worked there also.
Right. Right.
Trying to get a dead weight body over two fences. I mean, we just heard about trying to get one live body over one fence. Trying to get a dead weight person over two fences would be quite the challenge.
Note to self, buy a catapult.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's worth saying, I know there's certainly humorous questions and I'm sure adventures that you've had on the body farm, Rhiannon, but it's also worth, you know, talking about some of the things that this type of science informs. I mean, personally, I recently read a book called No Stone Unturned. It's about a necro search, which is a group, volunteer group that looks for clandestine burials. And the amount, the number of disciplines that can inform that type of investigation is amazing. I mean, I know some of your background is in entomology and insects specifically. So it's not just, are there like botanists and entomologists? And
that is correct. There have been some entomological studies on the body farm for studying insects and also related to that postmortem interval, which has been pretty important.
It's not just like people who study anatomy or study decomposition science. There's all types of fields that can be informed by this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so again, it's not all bodies laying out. It's people buried at different depths, people with different kind of interventions in terms of maybe hiding a grave or, you know, just determining the age of a deceased person, because people do die unattended in all kinds of places. And you know, for people who are superstitious, I'm always living in a city like Philadelphia. People are like, oh, the person died in my house. And I'm like, girl, if your house is over 100 years old, multiple people probably died in it. And that's okay. There's all different types of circumstances of death. And the body farm can help kind of demystify some of those things that might look more grisly than they really are.
I'd also like to relate back to what you said earlier and note that if you do donate your organs or even some of your bones, you can still be donated to a body farm if you are interested.
Oh,
and
okay.
If you have an infectious disease, you can also still be donated. However, you must be cremated, but just not pulverized.
Flesh is bones to make our bread.
So cremated bones are actually really useful in determining like the sex, ancestry, weight, height of an individual who might have died in a fire or something of that sort.
Okay, so we got fire investigation coming in here too.
Yeah, all kinds of research is done with the donors.
Yeah. I have a kind of personal interest in missing and murdered people. I have an Instagram account trying to identify different John and Jane Does from around the country based on tattoos. But, you know, there are a lot of people missing and a lot of families looking for people, and any information that can not only help locate clandestine burials, but also help identify people concretely if they've been deceased for quite a while, you know. Obviously, it's interesting as a scientific practice, but it can also really provide a good amount of emotional closure for people, too. So I think the body farm's super cool. I would like to go there in life and also in death, but I'm far away. There's a couple different body farms around the country. I guess we should clarify that. The one in Tennessee, I think, is one of the longest running.
Maybe? It was the first one to exist.
But there are other body farms around the country, so definitely take a gander. And if you are within 100 miles of one, check it out as an option.
Nancy, what is that Instagram account of yours?
Sorry?
That Instagram account, what is it? What is the handle?
Oh, it is at unidentified tattoos.
All one word?
Yep, all one word. And again, I just post mostly from the Doe Network, but I also pull from news stories and things like that sometimes. I think there's a lot of information that says, like, oh, if you have tattoos, it'll be really easy to identify you. And while that's certainly the case over someone who's not tattooed, you can definitely still have some pretty distinctive tattoos and not be identified. So there are websites to look at John and Jane Doe's, but you can't really filter it just for people who have tattoos. And I know a number of tattoo artists who can really, you know, offer a lot of information based on the art style, the period, things like that. So making it easy for people who have that knowledge to only look at the body art seemed like a useful thing. So it's still pretty new. I don't have too many posts up there. I think there's, you know, a little over 50 right now, but there's certainly a higher number of unidentified people to come. So,
and suddenly we became a true crime podcast.
I know, right? Well, thank you, Rhiannon, for joining this party. Is there anything else you wanted people to know about the body farm or your work, your time working there? Any kind of humorous, heartwarming, uplifting tidbits? We definitely are interested in hearing them, so lay them on us.
Well, one of my favorite things is that if you donate your body or your family member's body to the body farm, you can visit their skeleton. And if that's something you are interested in,
you can still go visit your family member or be visited by loved ones as a skeleton.
Absolutely.
That sounds fun. Well, thank you so much for joining us and on your lunch break, no less. And hopefully,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, hopefully we get a few people who are a little more interested and, you know, not quite as put off maybe, or, you know, just confused about what a body farm is and what it's for, and maybe a few more skeletons for the collection down there.
Oh boy.
I hope so.
So, Nancy, do I understand correctly your plans are organ donation then body farm right now? Is that where we are?
That's what I would like to do. I mean, I'm also fine with cadaver study. Again, my family doesn't really do burial the way that I guess most people kind of think about death in America as a cemetery. And as much as I am a fan of cemeteries, it's just not something that my family's done for the last several generations. So we kind of go organ donation, science, and then cremation if you can't do either of those. So
I have asked not to be embalmed because I don't think that that's a procedure that has very much worth. Like, I don't care if my body takes a long time to rot. So in my will, I've said, throw me in a burlap sack or a cardboard box and throw me in the dirt. But I have considered, you know, I have a weird skull. Let's not get into that in too much detail. But the museum might want my skull after I go. And if that happens, then I don't see, like, why I shouldn't part out the rest of me to other places that might want it.
Yeah. Well, Rhiannon just said that they'll take the rest of you. Maybe they will put you in a burlap sack. Who knows? Oh,
that'd be awesome. Headless corpse in a burlap sack. Sold.
So we've covered organ donation. We've covered donating to medical schools and educational facilities, be that in the form of cadaver study or something like a body farm. There is another option, and this is something that is a little bit testy, and I would definitely encourage everyone to do a lot of research on this if this is an option that you're considering. And so the third option and the last option I want to cover is donating your body to private research. The reason I bring this up is that it is a lowest cost or a no cost option, as private facilities can cover things like transportation and cremation for you a little bit easier than maybe universities or you know, public educational institutions. I do want to make it abundantly clear that it is illegal to pay for a cadaver in the United States. It is legal to buy and sell human remains in some states, as long as they are not viable for transplant or stolen, but you cannot pay for a cadaver for research. There is a huge variety of potential uses for your body for private research, and you don't usually get to dictate what that use is. But it's all for science, and these private research facilities do usually return cremated remains to the next of kin if that's something that's important to you. So these private research facilities, they're, it's all going to be science, right? But it's maybe less prestigious science that they're doing. It can be things like equipment injuries, auto accidents, things like that, rather than educating the future generation of doctors. However, again, it's still science. It's still worthwhile. So if having tangible remains returned is important to you and cost versus value is something you're considering, I would definitely encourage you to look into private research donation, but definitely, definitely do your research, because again, this offers a lot less transparency about what exactly your body is going to be used for and a lot less agency of allowing you to dictate what it's used for. There's a ton of different websites that you can look at for this. Medcure.org, biogift.org, sciencecare.com are three of them. The museum is not affiliated with any of them, and I am in no way promoting one or these three over any others. Those are just kind of like the top three that come up when you first look into this. So visit their sites, check out all their information, and carefully consider your options. I know that people have different priorities when they think about their death plans, and I thought it would be remiss to not include that as a potential option. And so for whole body donation, things like age are not usually a limitation, but again, things like being severely over or underweight, having a transmittable disease, missing too many limbs, organs, parts, those kinds of things can make bodies ineligible for certain types of science. You can discuss all of these factors with your donation coordinator at whichever organization or institution that you choose to look into. So with any end of life arrangement, and as someone who has kind of dealt with this from both sides, both with my own personal family members and also working at the museum, it's really helpful not only to your family, your next of kin, whoever is helping you out, but also to making sure that your wishes are met exactly how you'd like them to be. If you make these plans pre-mortem while you are alive, and make sure your next of kin is informed and aware of them. Get all that paperwork in a row, make sure they know where it is and how to find it and what their first step should be. It's a really good idea also to let your doctor know and put your wishes in writing, maybe via a will or with a lawyer, some kind of advance directive, whatever the option is for you at your age and marital status and all that kind of thing. If you don't have an advance directive at this point, and I know that I don't and I really should, you can get a template or state-specific forms and all that good stuff at caringinfo.org. So to kind of get started on your own, if you maybe are not ready to approach a lawyer yet, or you're still kind of feeling out what your options are. I'm 30, so I'm basically a withered crone at this point.
Look at her. She's old.
Yes. But there is a book called So I'm Dead, Now What? And it's kind of a good walkthrough of all of the things that maybe you wouldn't think about your family needing, things like passwords and like what kind of online accounts you have and where you keep your financial documents. Because personally, I lost a sibling about 8 years ago now, and it doesn't even occur to you, but we had to get into his computer. And if he hadn't shown my sister what his password was, you know, you're like, not only has your relative died or whatever, but now you're like cursing them for having too strong of a security protocol on their computer. So, you know, aside from your personal end of life wishes and, you know, supporting scientific research with your body, if that's your jam, do your family a favor and leave some instructions, you know, because they wouldn't, personally, my family would never guess some of my passwords. So fill out the book, hide it somewhere, tell like maybe two people where to find it.
Well, I read through that handbook for the recently deceased.
Go from there. It's one of these things where I think people who don't work in death care or death, you know, medical industries where death is present, maybe think that this is a morbid subject, but it's not. It's really about making a decision that's good for you and like allows you to feel maybe a little bit better about your death, but maybe allows your family to feel a little bit better about your death. You know, obviously you're always going to miss a person when they're gone, but I don't think that dying necessarily has to be this like huge traumatic thing for everybody. It certainly is sometimes, but you know, in a perfect world, if we could all plan our deaths to a T, it wouldn't be so bad. But you know, here, there's a couple things you can control about your death, and this is one of them. So make your plans, set it in writing, tell the people who need to know. Dream about the day that a young, scared medical student gets to look upon your corpse and think about, you know, what a huge favor you've done for them. I'm not here to shame anybody who might not be comfortable with donating their body to science and maybe just like wants to know exactly that they're going to go in like a nice satin lined box and go in a nice ground near where their family is. That's totally fine if that's your jam. But if you are thinking about other options or thinking about ways to, you know, like do the biggest type of recycling that you can, something to look into. Well, I mean, hopefully we ended on a high-ish note with, you know, kind of taking agency and control of your own death, but let's still, just in case, follow it up with a unicorn chaser. Mike, what's making you real happy this week?
Well, I am very glad you asked. So, last episode, we cut about 5 minutes of me going on about my favorite band, which was not really part of the story, so it was a righteous cut. But one thing I did mention was that my favorite band in the entire planet is Blue Oyster Cult. Not the Blue Oyster Cult. No article, just Blue Oyster Cult. And of course, they've been around since the late 60s. They are some people call them classic rock, some people call them prog rock, some people call them heavy metal. They're all of the above. You know, they started out before those genre distinctions were a thing. But they really are in many ways a groundbreaking band. And they released their latest studio album, the first studio album in almost 20 years. Just recently. It's called The Symbol Remains, and I'm happy to report that it is fantastic. It's all killer, no filler. Every single track on there is a winner, except the one they call Florida Man I don't love so much, but the rest of them are great. It's also worth noting the album is called The Symbol Remains, and the Blue Oyster Cult symbol, the logo, I have a huge tattoo of. So it's doubly exciting for me because the album cover looks kind of like my tattoo. That was my noise of enthusiasm.
Fangirling.
Yep. I don't know if they have a lot of albums left in them. I mean, they have been around for 50 years now. But if this is the last one, that's okay, because this was a great one to go out on.
That sounds good.
What's your unicorn chaser?
I think this might be kind of a cop-out, but I think my unicorn chaser is just going to be Halloween. Because, let me tell you, I had a little Halloween miracle last weekend. I was hoping to pick up pumpkins, and the store appeared to be all out. But in the last moment, in the bottom of the pallet, two pumpkins left. And so my partner and I are going to carve up our jack-o'-lanterns this Halloween. I have a number of nieces and nephews and sort of semi-adjacent children in my life. Again, there's no trick-or-treating this year because of COVID, but I've been donning my PPE and packing little goodie bags for them, you know, with my mask and my gloves on to kind of give to friends who have kids and my siblings with children so that they still get the Halloween experience at least a little bit. So I am sad that I will not get to see a bunch of kids enthusiastically donning costumes in my neighborhood. But at the same time, we still get to decorate and carve pumpkins and, you know, safely do our best to distribute sweets and treats to the kiddos in our lives. So looking forward to it. Very excited to amp up the decorations as we get closer. So,
well, our listeners are going to be hearing this 2 weeks after Halloween because we usually record 3 weeks in advance. So I hope everybody had a fun, safe, and spooky Halloween.
Yeah. I hope everyone enjoyed their spooky season. I'm certainly making it kind of a central part of my fun in the off time. So, yep. Well, thank you, everybody, to listening. Thank you, Mike, for telling me horrible things. Thank you, Rhiannon, for telling us less horrible things. And, you know, what is it this week?
Stay healthy and don't get mule spinner scrotum.
Stay healthy and sign your advance directive.
There you go.
Yeah.
Have a good one, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Chim chimini, chim chimini, chim chim, chim scrotum. Old Percival Potts is well pleased when you quote him. Chim chimini, chim chimini, chim chim, chiroo. The cancer sloughs off with an arsenic goo. Confidence at once, they cause cancer too.
Oh, no, I was just saying that's, I was going to say it's nuts, but then I stopped because...